From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to the Friday edition of Washington Watch. I am your host today, Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council. I'm filling in for Tony Perkins on this Friday afternoon. Well, I'll kick off the show with some whistleblowing on gender identity and transgender therapies from across the pond. Experts on gender dysphoria are accusing the Tavistock Clinic, England's only gender clinic, of using deceptive tactics to coerce children into taking hormones and puberty blockers that are irreversible. I'll talk with Brandon Showalter, a Christian Post reporter, about his new piece entitled Gender Experts Warn Parents of Deception and Surgical Horrors Awaiting Kids. In my second segment, we'll talk the Electoral College, the 200-year-old institution that could be more important now than ever. I'll talk with Sherritt Stepman, author of a fascinating new Daily Signal column entitled The Left's Attacks on the Electoral College Are All About Political Power. At the bottom of the hour, last night in Indianapolis, Indiana, Joe Biden decided to pile on, claiming that the Christian right has made a Faustian bargain with Donald Trump. Biden just besmirched Christian Americans before and now joins the likes of President Obama, Hillary Clinton, and Mayor Pete most recently in attacking a hugely significant voting bloc. I've got the audio and will give you my analysis. And at 42 past the hour, I'll revisit the Parkland, Florida shooting on February 14th, 2018. It might be called the most avoidable mass murder in recent history. It claimed the lives of 17 students and staff and injured 17 others. But do we know the whole story? The policies that made it inevitable are being forced into public schools across the U.S. I'll talk with Max Eden, Manhattan Institute fellow and co-author of Why Meadow Died. As a reminder, our podcast is at TonyPerkins.com. Follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins or me, if you'd care to, at Sarah P. Perry. Well, experts on gender dysphoria are accusing the Tavistock Clinic in England of using deceptive tactics to actually coerce children into taking hormones and puberty blockers that are irreversible. In fact, in the past decade, the number of young people referred for medical help to transition their genders has increased by over 4,000%. Most of the patients are young girls. So to help me set the stage for this discussion about how illegitimate so-called gender transition is, I want you to hear an excellent soundbite from Christian columnist Matt Walsh on gender identity. Let's listen.
How precisely does a biological male come to the conclusion that he is really a woman? How does this process work? If he arrives at this conclusion based on the fact that he feels like a woman, how does he know what it feels like to be a woman if he's not one? Is it not circular logic to say that he knows what it feels like to be a woman because he feels like one and therefore is one? That makes no sense. What exactly is a female feeling? Even if it made sense to speak of female feelings and female thoughts, and even if it were possible for a man to know that he was experiencing one, why would that mean that he is a woman instead of just a feminine man? We used to have those. Those used to exist. The left tells us that gender is a social construct. They reject the idea that women must necessarily have any particular feeling or thought or taste or preference. So if gender is an artificial construct and our physical features have no bearing on our identity as man or woman, then what the hell is a woman anyway? A woman in that case would not be defined by her feelings, her thoughts, her ideas, her preferences, her body, her reproductive organs, her DNA, her chromosome. Well, what is she defined by? What is she? Can anyone answer that? See, when a man says that he's a woman, he's now made it so that that phrase means nothing. It doesn't mean anything to be a woman. He might as well say that he's a who's a what's it or a thingamadoodle. It's just a word. It means nothing anymore. This is the real harm that this transgenderism nonsense has caused. Not only does it foment confusion in the minds of children, but it also cheapens womanhood by turning it into some kind of abstract concept that we theorize about.
Oh, I want to high-five Matt Walsh after hearing that clip. Going back to England, affiliated medical staff are going public about the misleading advice they gave to children suffering from a range of conditions, according to a Saturday report in the UK Sunday Times. Christy Entwistle, who until last October was a psychologist at the Gender Identity Development Service in Leeds accused the Tavistock Gender Clinic of misleading young patients, saying they are making decisions that will have a major impact on children and young people's bodies and lives without a robust evidence base. Joining me now to document the harm caused by these so-called gender transitions and his new Christian Post article is Brandon Showalter, a Christian Post reporter and a fellow of the John Jay Institute for Faith, Society, and Law. Brandon, so happy to have you on Washington Watch.
Thank you, Sarah. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So tell me about the July 18th open letter from Kirstie Entwistle. She's the former psychologist at the Tavistock Clinic. So this is an individual who has real expertise and factual awareness of what was going on the inside. Tell me about the letter.
Well, the letter was written, as you mentioned, it was an open letter that was posted online to Polly Carmichael, the director of the Tavistock Clinic, the lone gender clinic in the UK, outlining her concerns about the internal protocols within that clinic, namely that there was an unspoken rule that the clinicians were never to tell children that, or tell the families that their children were, in fact, not transgender for risk of being called transphobic. And it just seemed as though they were never to explore any kind of other underlying factors or any kind of other psychological causes that led these children to think of themselves as the opposite sex. But this was a very good letter, and it's really what made the news, and hence my own coverage of it.
So this unspoken rule, which here I am as a parent of three children, I find unconscionable. My parents, who I deal with, who I talk to, we cannot see our children be administered so much as Tylenol at a medical office without
right.
information being received from the front desk, from the doctor, from the practitioners. But here, the fear of transphobia apparently muzzles these individuals so that they are willing to go to overt, deceptive routes to prevent this information. So how did the Gender Identity Development Service respond?
Well, they responded by saying that less than half of their patients, fewer than half, are given these puberty blockers, and they sort of made light of it. But I can tell you, as a reporter who has covered this issue extensively, yes, I followed what's going on in the UK, but also here, the deception and the draconian policies that are in place in these gender clinics and even in the schools, it's as though the parents are kept in the dark, and it's so just unbelievably awful. As you mentioned, you know, children can't get a Tylenol at school, or there's, you know, they have to get their parents' approval to have a tattoo. But somehow it's allowed that if they say that they are the opposite sex, that then they have to be funneled off and shielded from their parents because their parents might support it. I mean, it's absolutely, in my opinion, diabolical, and that's not that's not hyperbole. It's really
that's
that bad.
That's not overstating it. No, it absolutely isn't. Let me also say that the letter that Entwistle published, this open letter, made note of the fact that these kids, many of whom had had traumatic events in their early years, were
right.
being set on this irreversible course. And you and I know, having corresponded on this and all of your excellent writing, a large portion, a full 30% here in the United States of these individuals who express gender dysphoria have developmental disabilities like autism spectrum
right.
disorder. So there are numerous other factors at play here,
right.
and yet these children are funneled in to this very convenient, politically overt, diabolical, as you've described it so appropriately, avenue to make sure that this political philosophy comes to fruition. So a UK women's rights activist group, and this is a group called Standing for Women, they had something to say about these medical and surgical interventions. So how did they actually get involved?
Well, these are a courageous group of British women. They're all across the political spectrum. I believe it's led by a wonderful lady I've had the opportunity to meet. Her name is Kelly J. Keeman-Schul. She also goes by Posey Parker. Venice Allen is another person who works with her. They've done a terrific thing in England. These are not Christians, but they're, you know, feminist-leaning, you know, left-leaning politically women who see this for what it is, and they've made no They've not hidden their disgust for these practices, and they believe that transing children is a vicious form of child abuse, and they've said so. And they've put on protests, and one more most recently, earlier this month, outside of an education conference where the country's leading gay rights group, Stonewall, which the equivalent of that here in the U.S. would be the Human Rights Campaign, mm-hmm. where they were furthering this philosophy of transgenderism into educators. And so they stood outside with posters of some of these grotesque surgical interventions that are done on young people, including double mastectomies where these young girls have their breasts, including the nipples, sliced off, and phalloplasties, where they take chunks of flesh from the forearm of a girl and to fashion it into a fake, you know, a pseudo penis. It doesn't work, but these are grotesque surgical interventions. And the fact that it's under the guise of medicine is just all the more appalling. But they've shown the pictures. They're ripping the mask off of these horrors, and they're making it such that no one can say they did not know what was going on at Tavistock and elsewhere.
So I think Posey Parker, who I'm a huge fan of what she is doing across the pond on this notion of the transgender cult, which truly has a cult mentality. It is accept no dissent. It is everyone coming under the umbrella of uniformly, without qualification, accepting this notion that gender is a social construct. And that kind of rigidity in thinking is nothing but a cult. She has really brought this debate to the forefront, and what she has done in this discussion, she's talked about these life-altering surgeries. They are momentarily confusing kids as well as giving them hormone blockers. So these children who are finding an avenue for whatever discontent is in their minds are actually finding what appear to be receptive homes in these gender clinics with these in America here, as well as the gender clinics, the individuals who are tasked with taking care of these children and yet are shoehorning them down this avenue of political correctness. These young women and girls, and young men as well, but particularly young women and girls, as the stats indicate in your piece, are being misled to think they can't conform to society standards and have to transition. That is the only option. I find this outrageous, and I know that you do too.
Well, I do, and I would just want to point out one thing that I think we as Christians need to stop saying. I think Matt Walsh has a great clip there. What the gender activists are saying is that actually sex is the social construct. Gender has been expressed in a variety of ways throughout history. It's really sex is the target. I mean, there is no such thing as biological gender, really. We need to stop saying gender when we really mean sex. I want to just underscore that. Otherwise, Matt Walsh knocked it out of the park.
Correct.
But yes,
and that's a great
sex
distinction.
Sex is not a social construct. It is a material reality, and we shouldn't conflate the two. But the point is clear, and it's this sleight of hand, this manipulative sleight of hand that the activists use when they somehow say that they want to transition to the opposite gender, when what they really mean is sex, and it is impossible to change sex. Human beings cannot change sex. We need to say it loudly, we need to say it often, and we need to lock arms with anybody else who agrees, because, frankly, that's most people, but they're just too afraid to say so.
Brandon Showalter, you've been my guest today on Washington Watch from the Christian Post. Thanks for being with us. You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, Jared Stepman from the Daily Signal and the Electoral College.
Can United States senators interrogate court nominees on their religious beliefs? This is a controversial question that our country is facing today. In light of this controversy, FRC has taken up the task of answering this question with one of their latest publications, Rebels Without a Clause. We've seen in recent Senate confirmation hearings a troubling pattern arise where senators have begun questioning presidential nominees about their faith as an attempt to discredit them. These interrogations have gone so far as to asking nominees of their theological beliefs, church membership, and associations with faith-based nonprofits. It has been an alarming display of hostility toward religion and people of faith. Visit frc.org/test to learn what questioning the Constitution's no religious test clause allows and forbids in the process of confirming judicial nominees. That's frc.org/test.
The latest Trojan horse on Capitol Hill is called the Equality Act. The way the left is advertising this bill is misleading because it does not further equality at all. It would actually violate current protections in place that allow private institutions and people of faith to freely act in accordance to their deeply held beliefs. The Equality Act explicitly removes religious liberty protections that were originally put in place with bipartisan support. Its stated goal is equality, but its actual result is harm to vast members of communities, individuals, and Americans as a whole by undercutting our foundational freedom of religion. Is this really what equality looks like? A more fitting name for the Equality Act would be the Inequality Act. For more information on the mass threat of the Equality Act, visit frc.org/EqualityAct2019. That's frc.org/EqualityAct2019.
Many advances made by the homosexual movement are based on the claim that sexual orientation is immutable or unchangeable. This belief was a deciding factor in the 2015 Supreme Court case that redefined marriage to include same-sex couples. It has been a key argument for LGB activists fighting to restrict or ban therapies for people seeking help to overcome their same-sex attraction. But is sexual orientation written in stone? Should we brand people with an immovable sexual orientation label and tell them, you can't change, don't try to change, even if they want to? In a new publication from FRC, we reveal that sexual orientation can change. Survey data shows that heterosexuality is largely stable, but homosexuality is not. Even pro-LGB scholars are calling for the immutability argument to be abandoned. The question is, why is the LGB movement pushing this false argument? To learn more, visit frc.org/sexualorientation. That's frc.org/sexualorientation.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Well, my next guest is Jared Stepman of the Daily Signal, and he has a new column entitled The Left's Attacks on the Electoral College Are All About Political Power. He writes, quote, "It seems that there isn't a prominent progressive person left in America who hasn't come out in favor of abolishing the Electoral College. The latest is Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who called for an end to our 200-plus-year-old presidential election system on Twitter earlier this month. Sanders didn't explain why he wanted to ditch the Electoral College, but it's interesting that as a senator from a small state, he has benefited enormously from the supposedly undemocratic nature of the American political system. So much for one man, one vote. Selecting or suggesting that the Electoral College defeat for Hillary Clinton suddenly means it is outdated or doesn't work is without merit." Well, Jared Stepman is also, in addition to his work as contributor to the Daily Signal, host of the Right Side of History podcast. Jared, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you very much.
So I'm sensing a little bit of hypocrisy on the part of Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. What do you make of his call to abolish the Electoral College?
Yeah, there is certainly a little bit of hypocrisy, and to a certain extent, it's unsurprising. I mean, we've seen a lot of big-name progressives in the last few years. I mean, former Attorney General Eric Holder, of course, Hillary Clinton, who ran in 2016, calling for its end. We've had a nationwide movement to bring people along to the so-called national popular vote compact, which is a way to try to get around the Electoral College, the Constitutional Electoral College. So it is entirely surprising to see Senator Bernie Sanders come out for something like this. What is maybe surprising is that the entire, I would say, progressive left now has become united in abolishing this institution. I mean, I think there are some very good reasons for that. I think a lot of them are political. And of course, as I argued in my piece, I think a lot of its power, I think progressives think that in national elections, their strategy and their philosophy has lost a lot of voters. And I think that to a certain extent, they don't want to do the hard work of winning them back. I think they want to change the American electoral system to fit their current strategies, which I think is incredibly short-sighted.
Well, you ask a great question and something that I'm sure sort of cogent, savvy readers of your piece might even be thinking themselves, what if Republicans currently had an electoral college disadvantage? You know, we understand much was made of the fact that Hillary Clinton lost the electoral college but won the popular vote. So let's flip the narrative on its head and say that Republicans are disadvantaged by electoral college distribution. Do we think, and I think I know how you'll answer, that there would be the same philosophy, the same repetitive narrative from the left?
I think the answer is absolutely not. I think that we'd be seeing countless stories about how conservatives or Republicans couldn't win over certain voters in this country, how they're losing these battles because their message is wrong, because their ideas are wrong. And to me, that's really what strikes the heart of this right now. I mean, the fact of the matter is that there used to be something, what people used to call the blue wall in the Rust Belt in large parts of the Midwest, states like Pennsylvania and Michigan, where I think up until recently, pretty solidly Democratic in presidential elections. 2016 election, I think, changed all that. You had a very different candidate, President Donald Trump, who ran with a little bit different message, a little non-traditional, and won over a lot of the voters in those states and appealed to those states and changed an election. The idea that the system is simply unfair to Democrats who can't win. Frankly, political parties have been jockeying for our countries through our country's history. Parties change and ideas and people change. So this idea that suddenly the system now in 2019 is suddenly unfair, I think it's a ridiculous argument. I think it just strikes to me as brazenly partisan.
I think this is part also of a growing trend to dispatch with the historical notions of the principles upon which the nation was founded, things that have worked for 200 plus years, strictly to fit a more convenient political landscape. And you pointed out, wonderfully so, Alexander Hamilton wrote in Federalist 68, the Electoral College isn't perfect, but it is excellent, the theory being there had to be diffuse support across the country, state to state, individual groups of people, not to the nation as a giant, as you said, undifferentiated mass, which I think is really an appropriate characterization. Presidents must go out. They must do the work to speak for the people, to connect with the individuals in each unique state. And to be fair, Bernie Sanders, coming from a state as small as Vermont, actually stands in a position of benefit in terms of the next election because small states are often benefited by how many electoral colleges they vote. Population is lower. Electoral college votes are higher. So really, he's in a position to get as much benefit as possible. So is this in keeping with what you've seen there as well in terms of what other progressive candidates are saying?
Oh, I absolutely. I think this has become the norm. I think that a part of this movement, as I said, the National Popular Vote Compact, I think is very much directed toward the 2020 election, the 2024 election. I think that it's very obvious from what happened in 2016 that there was a real mismatch between the strategy of Hillary Clinton, who racked up a lot of big vote totals in places like New Orleans and whatnot, and racked up vote totals there, while missing out on a lot of voters who flipped from blue to red in states like Michigan, Pennsylvania. I think we had certainly a sea change that maybe we should have seen coming. But I think for a lot of progressives, I think this is a very popular thing among their base right now. I think their base really demands that they get rid of the Electoral College. They use words like democracy, things like this. And I think they think that that will appeal to more people. But I think it's kind of been – I think the cat is out of the bag a little bit. I think it's seen now as more of a partisan effort. And I think for a lot of Americans, when they take a step back and they try to understand why the founders created the system and they start to understand why it's worked for this country for such a long time. I mean, we have the most stable republic really in world history. And we've had over two centuries of mostly peaceful transitions of power from one president to the next. Our system was really designed for a large and growing republic. I think that that has borne out over
Jared
time.
Stepman,
it's simply changed.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but you have been listening to Washington Watch Week. time. We'll have to have you back. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, Biden makes an easy target of Christians yet again. We'll be back.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
There is unprecedented religious persecution around the globe. In recent years, research has found increasing governmental and social hostility towards religious believers worldwide. For the last 10 years, Christians have been harassed in more countries, including the United States, than any other religious group. While the specific threats to religious freedom vary in type and intensity, one common source is the legal and cultural support for apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws, which often threaten the freedom to choose or change one's faith. In a new publication from Family Research Council, we list which nations around the world have these unjust laws on the books and spotlight people who have faced severe penalties simply for sharing or changing their faith. For more information on religious hostility due to apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws around the world, visit frc.org/ABA laws. That's frc.org/ABA laws.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council, filling in for Tony Perkins. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast site. At T Perkins is Tony on Twitter. At Sarah P. Perry is mine. Well, you might be riled up in this next segment. Joe Biden, leader among the pack of Democratic presidential contenders, who, by the way, once painting himself as a liberal, was in Indiana last night and spoke to the Indianapolis Star exclusively. The reporter asked, why do you think Mike Pence and the Christian right have embraced Donald Trump, and how do you overcome that? End quote. Biden said, look, quote, I think they made a Faustian bargain. And I think that bargain is, as long as you say you're going to take on the LGBTQ community, as long as you say you're going to end abortion in any circumstance, as long as you say those things, we will overlook your personal conduct. We will overlook the things you say. And I think it's a bargain that more and more Christians, quote unquote, are beginning to walk away from. He's testing the limits of that. Look, everybody knows who Donald Trump is. Even the supporters know who he is as a person. I want you to notice two things about that quote. First, that Joe Biden used the term Christian with quotes, as if there is a question about the religious belief, about the sincerity of our convictions if we've voted for Trump. And second of all, this was a candidate who once painted himself as a moderate, but has since learned the value of the political pylon. And that is part of what we'll talk about today. I'm reminded of Biden's comments from his speech at the 2018 Human Rights Campaign dinner, in which he addressed the homosexual activist crowd about his thoughts on Christians last year. He claimed that some use religion and culture as a license to discriminate. Let's listen.
We should call out hypocrisy when we see it. And for a party that associates itself with Christianity, to say that it is okay to suggest that God would smile on the division of families at the hands of federal agents, that God would condone putting children in cages, has lost all claim to ever use religious language again.
So that was Pete Buttigieg, who on the second night of the Democratic debates on June 27th, the mayor, who many call Mayor Pete, pulled no punches after he asserted that Republicans who supported their Christian values and voted as such were hypocrites regarding the humanitarian crisis at the border. Once again, an easy target to say that because your beliefs do not align with mine, because they are informed by a faith I do not have, you are out of touch not only with society as a whole, but a hypocrite to your own belief system. For someone who does not hold those beliefs, I have a hard time listening to it with a straight face. Joe Biden had a comment in front of the Human Rights Campaign dinner. Let's listen to that comment from Joe Biden.
These forces of intolerance remain determined to undermine and roll back the progress you all have made. This time, they, not you, have an ally in the White House. This time, they have an ally. They're a small percentage of the American people, virulent people, some of them the dregs of society.
Virulent people, the dregs of society. Well, Joe Biden, we are a full 36% of the voting electorate. And if you include those who identify not specifically as evangelical or born again, but just consider themselves to be Christian, an additional 37%. That's 73% of the population. I think you just offended Joe Biden. Let's connect the dots. Remember when candidate Barack Obama said at another fundraiser behind closed doors in San Francisco in April 2008, many years ago, Obama said just weeks ahead of the Pennsylvania primary that people of the Keystone State and many other Midwesterners are stuck in the past. Turn up the volume on your radio. The audio is a bit grainy here, but you have to listen.
Well, it's not surprising then that they get better. They cling to guns or religion or antipathy towards people who aren't like them, or anti-immigrant sentiment, or, you know, anti-trade sentiment. A way to explain their frustrations.
I'm not quite sure that Obama is using that word correctly. Antipathy, meaning dislike of, animus toward. No, we are for our perspectives, not against anyone who believes differently. You also must recall Hillary Clinton's fundraiser in July of 2016 in New York, where she famously gave a list of descriptions to describe the average Trump supporter. Listen.
You could put half of Trump supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. Right? The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it.
I really take issue with this comparison, but it's so easy to listen to someone who is very facilely setting aside their own unrighteousness, their own hypocrisy, and point to another individual saying that their voting choices make them a hypocrite, the dregs of society, racist, haters. These are not easy names for those of us who supported President Trump to withstand. However, we hold fast to our perspectives and to our beliefs. We are not electing a pastor in chief, but a president. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins here on Washington Watch. Coming up next, we're going back to Parkland, Florida, and the shooting on February 14th, 2018. Max Eden from Manhattan Institute joins me next.
Did you know that babies survive failed abortions? Sadly, many of these babies are denied their human right to life and are allowed to die. Currently, there is no federal criminal statute in place to protect these babies after they're born alive. Congress and state legislatures across the country have responded by putting forth legislation to protect infants who survive abortion. However, leftist politicians have blocked efforts in Congress and in state legislatures to pass the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which requires that life-saving medical care be given to babies born alive after failed abortion attempts. We must decide as a country where we stand on the issue of infanticide, to either pursue humane protections for those most vulnerable in our society, or continue to subject innocent human life to the whims of abortionists. For more information, visit frc.org/bornalive. Today, military personnel are at greater risk than ever of suffering from a mental health condition. On average, 21 active and retired military members take their own lives every day. Richard Gleaston, a military and veteran advocate in the area of mental health, recently shared evidence that faith-based solutions can help stop this crisis. Here's what Richard had to say.
There's new science out that they watch people while they're praying or have a religious relationship. The frontal part of their brain, if I'm correct in remembering what they told me, it strengthens it. It reduces depression, reduces anxiety and stress while you're doing it. So not only did God give us prayer as a way to alleviate our spirit, it also alleviates our mind and our bodies. Our bodies react in a positive way to a faith-based relationship.
Visit frc.org/speakers to hear more.
Did you know that thanks to President Trump, abortion giant Planned Parenthood can no longer receive up to $60 million in federal funding? This new federal protection for the unborn is thanks to a rule change that the Trump administration implemented to the Title X Family Planning Grant Program, which will take effect in May 2019. Not only do the new Title X rule changes take funding away from our nation's largest abortion supplier, they also ensure that taxpayer dollars are not used for abortion and open the door for pro-life pregnancy resource centers and other faith-based organizations to apply for Title X funds, thus expanding the health care options of needy families who are experiencing unexpected pregnancies. For more information about the new Title X rule changes that protect the unborn and increase health care options, visit frc.org/Title X. That's frc.org/Title X.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council. I am sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday edition. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. Go to that site. Find more information about our guest today, shareable resources. Listen in online. Share it with your friends. There's lots of information here you will want to refer to again. Well, the Parkland, Florida school shooting in February of 2018 is not a time that we would necessarily want to revisit, except for one thing. The events are true, and they cover a very big story. It is perhaps the most avoidable mass murder in American history, claiming the lives of 17 students and staff, injuring 17 others. The policies that made it inevitable are being forced into public schools across America. So listen well, those of you who are parents. Hunter Pollack, whose sister Meadow was murdered at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School that day, said, quote, "The media obsessed for months about the type of rifle the killer used. It was all clickbait and politics, not answers or justice. My dad teamed up with Max Eden, one of America's leading education experts, to launch his own investigation. They found the answers to the questions the media refused to ask, questions about school safety that go far beyond the national gun debate. And the answers to those questions matter for parents, teachers, and school children nationwide," end quote. That's the foreword to a new book entitled Why Meadow Died, The People and Policies That Created the Parkland Shooter and Endanger America's Students. Joining me now is the co-author of that book, Max Eden. He is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, an expert in education, and a graduate of Yale University. Max, welcome to Washington Watch.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Sarah.
So I have to tell you, I read this book in very short order. It was probably done in 3 days. And for someone who goes home to three children and a host of other responsibilities, that's saying something. For those of you out there, I want to start by saying this book is available for pre-order on Amazon. So go to Amazon, search Why Meadow Died. You will see it available for pre-order. But I want to talk about a little bit the circumstances that transpired to bring you into a relationship with Andy Pollack, the father of Meadow Pollack, and talk a little bit about what transpired to bring the two of you together.
Yeah, so, you know, the first thing I saw about the Parkland shooting was what everybody saw, was the news, the horrible images, the sites. And second thing I saw was the CNN town hall, which was primarily about gun control. And I'm, you know, I'm an education guy. I don't really have an opinion either way on guns. But I couldn't help but notice as more and more students started coming forward to the media, there was this other story that was being somewhat told, but not quite, where these students said, we all knew that he could be a school shooter. He threatened to kill us. He threatened to kill our families. He brought bullets to school. He brought knives to school. And we kept on telling our administrators that. We kept on telling the assistant principals, and nothing ever happened to this kid. And when I heard that, a little switch tripped in my head. I thought, oh, well, Broward County became rather nationally famous for its initiative to not arrest students in school. So maybe that might have had something to do with how this the shooter slipped through the cracks. So I wrote a little op-ed, kind of going over the student statements, raising the question that very quickly became kind of the conservative counter-argument to gun control, which wasn't my intent. The intent was to figure out, is this true and what actually happened? But it immediately became, you know, political on both ends. Nobody seemed like they were going to answer the question. I eventually wanted to travel down there myself to talk to a few people, see if I could find some answers, talk to students, talk to teachers. Andy heard that there was a guy from D.C. in town. He calls me over to his house. I can't say no to him. I tell him what I'm doing. I give him some questions to take the next state commission meeting. And, you know, afterwards I text him and I say, hey, you know, let me know how it goes. And he responds and says, thanks, Max, for all your help. You're going to be a tremendous asset helping me find justice for my daughter's murder. And, you know, at that point, I knew that I had to come back, and I knew that I had to not just do a quick dive to try to answer a question, but to really, you know, help do justice for Meadow and help Andy find every answer that he needed. And that, as I realized, parents across the country need.
So let me sort of talk a little bit about one of the individuals that features prominently in this story. And it is one of those stories that is stranger than fiction and must truly be read to be believed, because the story isn't just the shooting. It is everything that led up to those particular events in February of 2018. One of the prominent figures in this chronology is a man named Robert Runcie, who came to Broward from Chicago in 2011 as the superintendent of the county's public schools. And he introduced a new program. Now, before I get to that program, you need to know that Chicago is the home of Obama. It is the home of the Weather Underground. It is the home of Arne Duncan, who was Secretary of Education and who also was the architect of the Common Core state standards. And we all know how schools have done under Common Core. And if you don't know, they're not doing well. The curriculum, but not really a curriculum. We will waste 7 instructional school days every year for teaching to the test. This is the Chicago out of which Robert Runcie comes. And so he introduced a program called Promise. Can you tell me about the Promise program?
Yeah. So, you know, the Promise program received a lot of attention as the conversation about what might have enabled this started. You know, some people said, I wonder if these disciplinary leniency policies in general played a role. And Superintendent Runcie stepped forward and said, that is fake news. He used the words fake news. The shooter was never referred to Promise, nor did he commit a Promise-eligible offense while in high school. And so when I saw those three words, while in high school, I suspected that, oh, perhaps he was referred to it while in middle school. And as the story is told, it turns out that he had been, and that the superintendent is the kind of guy who's willing to look parents of dead children in the eye and say that their true concerns are fake news for the sake of protecting his program, which the particulars of the program, it was an initiative to decriminalize crime, allegedly just misdemeanors. There were 13 misdemeanors listed, and it succeeded in decreasing crime by about 70% in the Broward County School District by not arresting students for crimes. Under the Promise Program, you could get up to 4 free misdemeanors a year, every year, before the school administrators were even allowed to talk to the school resource officer. But of course, it went much further than that in implementation. I talked to school resource officers who told me that if a police officer tried to come on campus to arrest a student who had committed a violent crime off campus, administrators were trained to tell the police officer, not only, you know, may you not come on campus, we won't even tell you whether or not the student was here. They were trained for their schools as sovereign territory. And according to the school resource officer, over and above the misdemeanors that were officially decriminalized under Promise, school resource officers were also trained to, it's not a violent felony. Maybe you don't really arrest for it either. And so it made great strides in reducing the amount of official crime in the Broward County School District. But
sure,
I'll tell you, so there was a poll that actually came out a couple of days ago in Broward asking teachers all sorts of questions about discipline. And only 38% of teachers said that if a student assaulted them, they would expect that student to be suspended.
Oh, wow.
So we're not even talking about, you know, decriminalizing. It's just, if you assault a teacher, 40% of teachers think that the kid's going to get suspended. 60% think something less severe than that's going to happen. And so it created this culture within the Broward School District where anything went, but it made Runcie famous. He made him a national all-star because he had so dramatically tried to stem the school-to-prison pipeline by lowering all these statistical indicators of problems.
And the whole goal of this Promise program was to, in effect, make sure that minority students or students with disabilities were not being disproportionately disadvantaged. And so the easy solution is don't report it. Don't report the misdemeanors and don't report the felonies under which there was no legal obligation to do with the Promise program. So here we are with Nicholas Cruz. Let's talk about him specifically. So now the Promise Program is sort of ground zero for the institution of this particular non-disciplinary policy. And it has to be said in terms of the chronology here, Runcie comes in 2011, January 2014, the Obama administration issues guidelines to national school boards, directing them to adopt Promise-like policies or risk a federal investigation and loss of their own tax dollars. That carrot and stick used much the way Arnie Duncan did with the Common Core adoption. So let's talk about Nicholas Cruz, 19 years old. He wasn't a minority, but he did have a disability. And a report came out earlier this week from the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights saying that students with disabilities are disproportionately disciplined. Do you think that is a problem? And if so, how do we deal with it?
Well, you know, if you look at the numbers in the aggregate, as the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights did, then it's certainly true that students with disabilities are disciplined more frequently. But if you control for background characteristics, you'll find that students with the kind of disabilities that you and I think of when we think of that, you know, students have a physical impairment, students have a learning disorder, students have dyslexia, they're actually disciplined substantially less frequently than the average students. After you apply proper controls, there's only one group of students with disabilities that's disciplined more frequently than the average students. And those are students with emotional and behavioral disturbance disability. So these are students who get tagged as having a disability because of their extreme and consistent bad behavior. Then you have a policy that comes along that basically says, you should try to discipline students with disabilities at the same rate as normal students. That tells school administrators, you should try to discipline students who behave consistently awfully at the same rate as students who behave consistently well.
I can't do anything but laugh. I really can't, because it is such a backward philosophy on school discipline and maintenance of order and the ability of teachers to do what they are supposed to do, which is go into their classrooms and instruct rather than worry that they're going to be assaulted or have to deal with a particular misdemeanor or, God forbid, a felony on a given day that they won't be allowed to report. I'm stymied by this. So Nicholas Cruz has a disability. Talk a little bit about his disciplinary background. What kind of a student was this?
This was a student who had to be hooked into a harness when he was in pre-K and kindergarten to be able to ride the school bus safely with others. This is a student who could never spend more than 3 months in a normal classroom when he was in elementary school. But part of what federal policy has done is this thing called least restrictive environment, right? We want to push students with disabilities into the least restrictive environment possible, which might make sense. The students with physical disabilities, learning impairments, you know, you don't necessarily want to shun them off into a separate corner, but with students like him, his only choice when he got to middle school was go to a traditional middle school or go to kind of a supermax facility for kids with extreme behavioral disorders. And between elementary and middle school, he tacked on 120 disciplinary offenses, some of which I'm going to keep, you know, in reserve when the book comes out because some are quite explosive. But everybody knew who he was, thought he was dangerous. It took them months and months and months of excessive documentation going through about a 5-month process to get him into the kind of specialized school that everybody knew he needed to go to. And then as soon as he behaved well enough there for a few months, they put him straight back in traditional school, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, knowing full well that he was obsessed with guns, that he had a documented fascination with killing. They thought to themselves, for some reason, I think this kid would benefit from being in JROTC. So, you know, we can talk about gun control so the cows come home. And again, I don't have an opinion on that. But the school district took a kid who they knew had an obsession with guns and an obsession with killing, put him into a normal high school, and literally let him practice marksmanship with an air gun. And then the funny thing, Sarah, is when he's in high school, that's where I did most of my sleuthing because the middle school record's clear. 125 disciplinary infractions, K through 12, only 5 of which for his 1 year in high school, which, trust me, does not match up with the descriptions about his actions given to me by teachers and students.
So we have about a minute left, and I hate to say that because I could talk to you for hours about this. It is fascinating to me, but there is a part of me that is also disheartened because there are organizations, governmental entities bigger than the individual parent, like myself, who are at work behind the scenes. The school district has not revised its policies. So what can parents do?
Yeah, I mean, parents are facing a really big uphill battle on this one. The Trump administration rescinded this federal Dear Colleague letter that Arne Duncan put in place. But there are all of these outside groups that are still trying to push this stuff. There's the American Civil Liberties Union. There's the Southern Poverty Law Center. They fundraise by convincing their donors that they're fighting racism and fixing the school-to-prison pipeline. And if they're the only people that superintendents are going to listen to, then these policies are going to continue. So the first thing parents need to do is talk to their teachers, talk to them off the record so the teachers don't fear retaliation. You know, figure out the questions to ask. Are things being hidden? Are there kids in my kid's classroom who just shouldn't be there? The first step is to get a grip out of it. And my hope is that, you know, hopefully the book, Why Meadow Died, available now on Amazon, can help spark a kind of wave that can make parents reclaim their schools, reclaim their classrooms, and then we can see with these policies what we were fortunately able to see with the Common Core the past few years, where, you know, first parents don't know, but then they take arms and take action.
Max Eden of the Manhattan Institute has been my excellent guest today. Go to Amazon. Why Meadow Died is the book title. We will have Max for more events and more press here at FRC. The story is compelling. The information indispensable. You've been listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry. We'll
Washington
see you next time.
Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. For more information on anything you've heard today or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.